Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Paul Casserly, former program director, and the brains behind Straw People. He tells us why having access to BFM's production studio was so important for his group. Welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Paul Casserly.
G'day.
Thanks for coming in. First, can you tell us what year you started at BFM and what you did when you were here first?
I think it was 85, but it was around about 85. Maybe I first poked my nose in the door in 84, but it was around about that time. And I think a friend of mine was doing a show here, and I heard about it and came along. It might have been Greg Johnson, but we were at university at the same time. And actually, no, he wasn't at university. He was at Tech. Over at ATI, as it was in those days. So I used to come up here. I think Joost Langreld was around about that time as well. And we had a band at that stage, and we played a few gigs at the uni caf and stuff.
What was that? The Bombers?
No, it was called Compulsory Allies.
Compulsory Allies.
And Greg Johnson was a singer, and I was drummer. And Joost was on bass, and we were kind of a weird combo of a ska-influenced jazz crossover. It was a strange one. It was kind of that post-punk thing, I suppose, but everything happened a lot later in New Zealand, so I think we were just getting that around about 85. And listening back to some early tapes of that recently, it was really quite awful. But a lot of music was awful back in those days. Music's really got better. People have got better at the actual mechanics of it, that's for sure. I kind of continued on with my BA trying to get a degree, but it never happened because I kind of came to BFM and that sort of became my university, so to speak. Not exactly the University of Hard Knocks, but something like that. I'm thinking the people who were around at the time, people like Nigel Snowden and Robert Southern, James Schoening, kind of bullies, to be honest, but not Robert, of course. Could never accuse Robert of being a bully, but it was kind of like that kind of hazing kind of school kind of vibe that was going on at that stage. But I somehow ended up doing the news, I think, and then I became the news director, which was kind of a semi-full-time position. June Arnery was the station manager at the time, because I'd applied to the ATI journalism school, but I missed out. So I ended up doing news on BFM and then doing lots of interviews and stuff, and that was kind of really what sort of got me going. And then in those days it was weird because I became the program director the year after that. You got voted in those days. It wasn't like a job you applied for. There was kind of the staff would vote. It was kind of I guess like a survivor style thing or something like that. I'm not sure. God knows how I got voted. How it worked. I must have just lucked out at the right time, I think. I sort of hung around for about 5 or 6 years in total, I think.
Wow.
And then I came back and I went away and came back in 91 for a year as program director when Liz Tarn was the station manager. It's hard to actually figure the exact dates, but I definitely went away for a couple of years. Maybe it was only a year, but it felt like a couple of years. And then I came back for one last gasp.
In 91.
Yeah. Hey, we used to have a magazine that the station published as well, originally called The Book of Biffham. And then that became Monitor magazine, and I edited that for, I think, 2 years as well, in there somewhere. Righto. This is a track called Kaz, and this was recorded here in the BFM studio on the old half-inch 8-track machine. I spent a lot of time in that studio back in the day with Mark Tierney. We used to record a lot of shit. Some of it saw the light of day, some of it didn't. But this was one of the ones that, one of the early ones that did, and it was an interview that I did with Miranda Harcourt, and she was doing a play downtown of, it was called Kaz, a Working Girl, and it's about prostitutes. She'd gone out and interviewed lots of prostitutes and researched this character, and then did the show that was based on the life of a 25-year-old prostitute or something in Auckland. And I did this interview with her, and part of the interview, she'd performed some of the play, and when I was listening back to it to edit up to play on air, I thought, hang on, we could stick some beats behind that and might make a bit of a track, you know, sort of influenced by those early kind of, I guess, maybe it was Tackhead and Brian Eno tracks and stuff that were around at that time. And so this is it. It's called Kaz, and it features the vocals of Miranda Harcourt, recorded right here at BFM, 1986.
I can work tomorrow night, get some more dough together, get myself over this bad pitch.
back soon. But sometimes I think walking the streets just an excuse to use. I've got one friend. She saves all she gets. Never buy snack. She's got colour TV, gold jewellery, Triumph stag car. Bringing the whole family over to Sydney.
As it's New Zealand Music Month, I think it's entirely appropriate that we talk about your old group, Straw People. That was yourself and Mark Tenney, who at the time was the production engineer.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So we spent a lot of time in the production studio working on stuff and recording. He recorded. He was more the engineer actually. He was very capable technically, and he recorded lots of bands in there. Actually, it was a bit of a hive of activity on the weekends. We'd pretty much spend all weekend in there, to be honest.
And you guys hooked up while you were here at BFM.
So
the Straw People really only existed because of the fact you guys were,
because we had access to the studio here at BFM,
and you were both working here.
So BFM's to blame for that. It was, yeah, it was great. I mean, to have access to a studio in those days was, you know, it wasn't like now where your Macintosh is a studio that you can have. In, you know, we didn't have all those bedroom Beethovens like you have now. It was hard to get access to a studio. So an 8-track machine was just like a, was just amazing to have, you know, free time to use it because we were working here and no one was using it overnight. And also what we're doing is we're experimenting in the studio as we went, kind of thing. So a lot of them were just tracks that were kind of, you know, throwing one thing down on one channel and then blah, 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 and carrying on. So we were using it to experiment with in it. And I guess that's, and back in those days, the only place you could do that was somewhere like here.
Later on, you, of course, worked with a number of different vocalists over the years, but later on you had Fiona McDonald on board. And
yeah, she was here at the same time that I was here. And at the same time, that's right, Greg Johnson was here at the same time. Greg was actually the office manager at one stage. And I remember when Greg quit, but we were pretty lazy and useless. And Greg was even lazier and more useless than the rest of us. And he got fired in the end. You know, we're getting paid like $20 a week or something at the stage. I remember that after he was fired, that we had a meeting and we were like, oh, should we replace Greg? And someone suggested that we should get a dog and just get it to sit outside because it would be more productive than Greg ever was, which was a bit harsh. But yeah, there weren't that many dogs at BFM actually over the years. I remember Andrew Black had one that he called Biko, after Steve Biko. Yeah, there went a lot of dogs. Nicer than Russell.
Yeah. So Straw People still continues, I believe.
Well, it's not really a band. It's when I get together in a studio with initially with Mark for the first few years, and but then it's just whoever. So it's kind of a collaboration that happens from time to time. But it was definitely back in the early 80s when we had the access to the studio here. And you know, more than one track ended up using interviews that I'd done as, you know, on air at BFM. I remember there was another one, a filmmaker called Peter Bradbury, who made a film about Chile and the Pinochet regime. And I ended up cutting up a lot of audio from that film and that interview. And that was a track that ended up on an album as well, because we were really influenced at that time by, you know, the things like the Eno and Burn, you know, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, and the cut-ups that were coming out of the UK at the time, Gary Clale and Tackhead and all that sort of stuff. That was kind of, especially for a non-musician like myself, it was kind of my way to get into music, was to cut up bits of audio and whack it together. In fact, this is one of those tracks now that was really influential, and it was from the David Byrne Eno album, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. And it's a track called The Jezebel Spirit, and it uses an actual recording of an actual exorcism set to the amazing music of, that Talking Heads, Eno-style stuff. Just track just blew us away when we heard it.
Thank you.
You were the program director here. Who were some of the sort of key people that were on air at the time when you were running the ship?
Graham Hill, I think, it started. Marcus Lush was starting to do talkback. Well, breakfast was, well, at this stage, breakfast was a different person every day. It wasn't like there wasn't a breakfast host. Sometimes someone would do it maybe for a couple of days in a row, but there wasn't a focus on breakfast at all in those days. I guess it was more lifestyle based as well. No one really wanted to get up that early, and because no one's getting paid, you know, you couldn't really get anyone to turn up every day to do that.
And you continued doing shows yourself?
Yeah, I did shows, and we devised some new shows in that time. I think we came up with the Culture Bunker, which was named after a Teardrop Explodes song. There may have been an arts program before that we changed that into, but I think we came up with that. And I think that was the beginning of the accommodation guide, which probably a lot of people probably hate me for. Yeah, I know. But sometimes when I'm driving along and I hear it, I'm like, oh, God. But I've got to say, I think the Back of the Wire guys deal with it in an extremely entertaining fashion. We'd just come out of the period back then when the station was going off air every couple of months, coming back on air. It was sort of starting to go full time, and we were still AM. Generally, what happened overnight was we had a CD changer, and it was like an 8 CD changer or something. We'd put it on, and whoever left last would leave their favourite CDs on, and you know, you'd often try and throw in something sort of weird, like some Gregorian chanting or something that was kind of new back then, you know, that hadn't been sort of thrashed, or you know, strange things that you'd hear in the middle of the night. But it was exciting time. It was pretty loose, and we didn't know what we were doing, and it was good. It's interesting. There's still a sting on air now from because we at the same time we came up with what we decided we would call the morning show The Wire as well, and we came up with you know. I mean, we didn't come up. It was not really an idea, but we packaged it as you know, the morning show called The Wire. And that sting, I think, that Mark Tierney voiced back in whatever year that was, in the late 80s, is still on air now. It's still the one that goes, The Wire.
Boing.
Yeah, well, because yeah. I think we'd also got, Rick had just gone in and some new gear into the production studio, a digital delay and a reverb, and we had it on everything in those days. It's funny still hearing that sting's all bouncing out over the airwaves.
Now, even though you were a program director, I know that there was back at that time, there was a lot of people would sort of get involved in all sorts of different areas. You kind of weren't limited to having to do this one thing. And I know that in particular, you were involved in a lot of the creative process. When I talked to Eddie Chambers, he was telling us about how you'd sort of get a brief for an ad. The client said, this is what the ad's got to be for. And then a bunch of you would gather in production or outside for a hacky sack, and then kind of just come up with an idea.
This was pre-hacky sack.
Pre-hacky sack, right, okay.
This pre-hacky was pre-hacky sack. Hacky sack hadn't yet been invented.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, that's why so many of them were so terrible. But occasionally there were good ones, and it's good to remember those. There was that kind of shit going on, and it was great. We spent a lot of time in there working on stupid characters and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure that obviously still goes on now from the ads that I hear at the moment. But and a lot of it sounded pretty terrible, to be honest. And I think people look at a lot of it with sort of rose tinted glasses. There was some pretty average broadcasting going on, and it's amazing that you guys have managed to hang on to that, to be honest. And it's probably one of the main things that really makes the station stand out from all the other ones. And it's definitely a style. I'd like to think that I was involved in creating that. Back in the day, that's probably a bit more complicated than that. Dad's Tips came about, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that the character of Dad came about, and I know that Graham Hill, Marcus Lush, Russell Kerr and myself put together these things called Dad's Tips that we'd play as a segment on the breakfast shows and on the just a sort of run of station. It might have started as an ad or something, I'm not exactly sure. But we came up with this character, Dad, who's kind of the Homer Simpson sort of style of thing, and it seemed to take off. And if I recall, I think the guys who came up with the funniest ideas for it were probably Graham Hill and Marcus Lush, actually, I'd say. In fact, Marcus was like a Dad's Tip generator. He was a walking Dad's Tip. It was partially based on, different characters that we knew who were kind of, you know, the archetypal old school dad, you know. Yes. In my case, it was actually, I'd been doing some part-time work as a panel operator at 1ZB, and I used to work with a guy called Chris Carter, who was a talkback host, And he was classic. He'd come off air and say things like, "Oh, I'm so hungry I could eat the snatch off a rag doll." And, you know, classic quotes like that all the time. And there was a few dad's tips. And he was always, you know, "I've got this great deal on a car and, you know, bloody, this guy's going to sell it to me for bloody half, bloody, bloody wholesale," and all this sort of stuff. And invariably, every deal he did would, you know, the car would break down or something. But he was a great, guy. And he inspired some. But it was just that Kiwi vernacular and that the old, you know, the old generation redneck kind of thing. "Oh, bloody Maoris everywhere. What's going on? Who's there?" You know, someone who's slightly deaf and, you know, "Hold on a minute. Hold on." And angry.
Yeah, there's angry. That's the Homer Simpson bit, wasn't it? And he did. Dad definitely harked back to an earlier era. So even though he was created in the 80s, he was kind of this guy from the 50s or the 60s. He was an old-fashioned Kiwi bloke.
Glenn was a bit gormless.
Not the smartest kid.
I think Glenn was played by a guy called Glenn initially. And I don't remember what happened to Glenn. I think he went to Australia. And then Russell Gurr played Glenn. But I actually think, if memory serves me right, I think it was before The Simpsons. There was my favourite one was actually the when we finally, I think we didn't kill off Dad, or maybe we did, but he's in hospital and he's nearing the end of his life.
"Look, I'll let you in to see him, but he's very sick. Dad's had a coronary arrest, a massive heart attack. Now try not to put him under too much strain."
Dad. "Oh. Are you here, Dad?"
"Oh, yeah, yeah."
"Oh, poor Dad, Glenn. He must be in a lot of pain."
"Oh, yeah.
Dad, are you in a lot of pain, Dad?"
"Oh, yeah, what? Why? Oh, Christ. Woman, never sneak up on a bloke when he's had a heart attack. Could give him a heart attack."
"I brought Glenn, Dad."
"Glenn, come over here. Have you got any fags, Glenn?"
"Dad, you just had a heart attack. Do you think you should be smoking?"
"Glenn, answer the bloody question. Have you got any fags?"
"Yes, Dad."
"Thought I told you not to smoke, boy. Mum, did you bring Nana with you?"
"No, I thought it best not to. I did what she said. I sellotaped some of the Christmas decorations to her ceiling and pointed the fan at them. She was laughing her head off when I left."
"Yeah, nothing like a bit of colour to entertain them that lose their facilities. Glenn, you scared, boy?"
"Did you might die, Dad?"
"Yep, that your old man might not be around a hell of a lot longer. Pretty serious business, the old ticker boy."
"Oh, you'll be all right, Dad."
"Never had much time for bloody Christmas anyway, buying stuff for a whole lot of people I didn't like that boyfriend of Vi's, that Pommy bloke. Bloody idiot."
"The one that came down with salmonella?"
"Yeah, him. What's his name? Bought that pate to the barbecue at Christmas Eve. When I noticed he was the only one eating it, I swapped it for the cat food. He never knew the bloody difference."
"Vi sends her love, and so does Sharon from the TAB. They had that Anita McNaught in there this morning."
"Oh, wouldn't mind taking a punt with her. Glenn, because it's Christmas, I've got you something. Mum's bought it with her. What do you think, boy?"
"I don't really know what to say, Dad."
"Glenn, you don't have to say anything. If I can't get my own son and heir a lucky dip in the Christmas $3 million draw, what kind of father would I be? Now leave your mother and me alone for a moment, will you, boy?"
"Okay, I'll be in the hall, you tight old bastard."
"Glenn, is that a spider in my bed?"
"Where?"
"Boy, never learn, Mum." "You're always my best girl, Mum. I know we had our differences and you were jealous of that Janelle for a long time, but I just want you to know, I never loved her. Never. Not for a moment. Except for maybe 20 minutes during the second half of that pirate movie when she said I looked like Dirk Bogarde and fell for my jaffers. I never loved her, Mum."
"Oh, no, Dad."
I wish I could have done more for you and the kids. Gone to that Knott's Berry Farm or that Disneyland, but Mum, I didn't want to spoil the kids the way Roy Speed next ordered. Everything that opens and shuts his kids had. And look what happened. Fell off the ladder and disemboweled himself on that easy trim. 90% of accidents happen in the home, and that's why Glenn did most of the work. It's probably why he's only got one toe. But he'll be the man of the house when I'm gone, and I know he's up to it."
"Dad, you're not going anywhere. You'll be up and about in no time. Back at the RSA, letting down the tyres on Nana's wheelchair, dropping wetters in Glenn's gumboots."
"No, Mum, I feel very peaceful inside. When I was in the ambulance, I felt something tugging at my spirit, calling me onto the great beyond, and I heard one far off calling my name. Dad, Mum, I think it was Jesus."
"What makes you say that, Dad?"
"Because when I said Christ stopped saying my name, he did."
"What happened then? Dad?"
Are you there, Mum?"
"Yes, I'm here, Dad."
"Is Glenn here, Mum?"
"Yes, Glenn's here, Dad."
"Is Auntie Vi here?"
"Auntie Vi's on her way, Dad."
"So you're all here?"
"Yes, Dad."
"Then who the hell's listening to the bloody races, Mum?" "Mum, I think I'm going."
"Oh, my God, I'll get Glenn. Glenn, it's your father. Run for the doctor."
Hang on.
"What is it, Dad?"
I'm not going. I just needed to break wind. It's getting very dark in here. Some bugger dim the lights.
I won't dim the lights, Dad.
Stroop, then maybe I am going. Glenn, come closer so I can see you. Glenn, I've always been hard on you because I didn't want you to end up a dancer or a bloody cello player. I tried to make a man out of you, Glenn. If you turned out a queer, I still would have loved you. In fact, the whole time I was wringing your bloody neck, I still would have loved you. Father always loves his son. But I know you're not one of those homos, because I've looked through your magazines. A bit saucy for me, though. Mind you that Helen from Malibu and her twin just about got the old hormones on the move. Glenn, I'm proud of you, boy. Well, I'm not proud. I'm pleased you're not a poofter, that's all. That's all. I'm pleased you're not a poofter.
Dad! Dad! Quick! Call a doctor!
Doctor! Doctor!
I'm sorry, Mum. Glenn, Dad is dead.
No, I'm not. I was just holding my breath. Bloody doctors, load of quacks, no nothing. Here, take this. Now bugger off. Don't trust doctors, don't trust Japos, don't trust Indians, don't trust Germans, don't trust those Italians. Don't trust anyone, especially Alzheimer's. Never met an Alz, but I wouldn't trust one if I did. Just don't trust.
Dad, Fi's here.
Stone the crows, what does she want?
Dad, you won the Quinella. In the first leg of the double, you won it.
Crikey, how much was it paying?
$20,000, Dad.
$20,000, bugger me days. Glenn, Glenn, I've hidden the keys to the car, so you're not driving even when I'm dead.
He's dead.
No, I'm not. Not yet. Not yet, I'm not. There's just one thing I've got to say. I know.
Bloody car park outside the RSA, you silly old bugger. I'm Bluey. Your Holden's parked in my space. You better bloody move it because I got to unload these kegs. You know old Seth, he just shouted the entire club to free beer.
Cripes, I am in heaven.
You look like you've seen a ghost, mate.
Mate, I just had a dream that it'd scare the spots off a tiger.
A leopard?
Nah, I'll stick with the lion red, mate, but thanks for asking. I tell you, Bluey, it must have been that cheese sandwich I had after the bowls tourney. I could have sworn I had a heart attack. I was in hospital. Mum was there, Glenn and Artie.
Oh, cripes!
Stone Martin and Jeff, you know what this means.
Did you miss out on Seth's show?
Nah, it means I haven't won the bloody Quinella after all. Oh, I wish I were dead. Bluey, whatever you do, don't eat a cheese sandwich before you have a kip.
Yeah, okay, well move the bloody thing, will you, mate?
Righto.
They were really politically correct days in those days around university here. It was an interesting time, you know. Crackham had changed its name to Kiora. You know, because in those days no one said kia ora. That, you know, it was just past the time when feminists were active on campus and they tied up that playwright to the tree.
That's
and stuff,
right, you know, in the and, park. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So it was like all this stuff was sort of coming alive in Auckland. So it was kind of an exciting time in that regard. And we were all very politically correct, actually, in a good sense. And it wasn't so much a reaction to that as more of a fondness for and sort of for nostalgia of and the comedy of old redneck people who you don't actually hate. It's just the way they are. It's kind of what was behind it, if one was to think much about it, which I don't think one should. You know, every now and then there was a song that would really excite everyone at the station, and you know, when you first hear it, you'd go, wow, what's that? And then, you know, for about a week you'd be thrashing it and just loving it every time and turning up at full noise when you got into the studio. And this is definitely one of those tracks, Huskadoo's New Day Rising.
We'll be right back.
I had a breakdown. And just jokes. I'm not quite sure what I was doing, but I think I was doing other work. I was doing a bit of work at 1ZB and stuff in those days, and Straw People would have been relatively busy. Yeah. No, I'm not sure what we actually did, to be honest. Probably just sat around drinking tea. I think this time, because the first time we came up with some new shows, I think this time we came up with a show called, well, maybe it was 91, I the Jury. And it was basically, you'd play the new releases of the week and you'd get three egotistical blowhards in to blow hard about them. It was quite entertaining, actually. I think Mark hosted it most of the time, Mark Tierney. Because I've always liked those shows where people, you know, rant and rave about stuff. And it was kind of a review show where people just went blew hard and were really, probably really mean, if I remember rightly. But it was very entertaining. I think that was the only new show that we launched in that year. The Wire was going then, the Culture Bunker was going then. Yeah, it was good fun coming back for a year, actually. Sort of slightly better at it by that stage. First time pretty ropey, pretty young, and thinking back, a bit of a wanker. Someone once told me at a party that I was a complete it was Timothy Giles though, so it doesn't matter. But it is funny when you think back, isn't it? And you know, that's what I love about BFM though, because it's such a collection of weirdos, really. You know, it's always been a bait catcher for misfits and weirdos. And someone I've been working with recently, a younger guy, saying, "Oh, I can't listen to BFM." I'm like, "Why not?" He's like, "Oh, it's like, oh hi, you're listening to BFM. I'm going to kill myself." That's kind of, you know, that's how a lot of people see it, and that's quite funny, you know, and kind of quite valid. But that's what I like about it. You know, a lot of the DJs sound like they're suicidal. It appeals to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I started working in television doing a show called Newsnight with Marcus Lush. That might have been a couple of years later, though. And Straw People stuff was getting pretty serious about it around that stage. We were recording quite a bit and spending a bit of time in Australia. So, yeah. But so I kind of always kept in touch, and then you know, I would do shows now and then, and then I got back into it in the early 2000s, doing a weekly Wire program and doing a bit of stuff around the station, a bit of stuff for the Sunday morning show and stuff, and a bit of production, a bit of behind the scenes stuff for a while, working with Mikey on the Havoc show when that was on MTV. Actually, yeah, that was around that time too. That was after. That was later. And doing the Havoc show when that was on TV2, and then working with Jeremy on Eating Media Lunch, and been doing that ever since, really. Just finished doing that last year. We did four series of the Unauthorised History of New Zealand, which was great fun, and getting to get stuck into the archives. And currently working on a show called Birdland, which is hosted by Jeremy Wells, and it's kind of a natural history meets Eating Media Lunch style crossover, somewhere in between there. But it's very much a departure, actually. It's very much about New Zealand and birds.
Just for the record, you're a writer / director, is that correct?
Yeah. This is another track that was recorded in the old BFM studio on the old 8-track machine. And I think Mark Tierney produced a lot of stuff early on for the Headless Chickens, and this is it's one of my favourite songs of theirs ever, actually, and it's a brilliant piece of Kiwiana, totaling Dad's car. Yeah.
Well, this year, 2009, BFM is celebrating its 40th anniversary. Amazing to think it's lasted 40 years. As someone who's been involved in many different facets of the station over the years, Paul, and watched it grow and watched a lot of talent kind of rise up, keen to hear your thoughts on why you think it's lasted so long and also what BFM is going to need to do to survive for another 40 years.
Well, how much time have you got? It's good that it's lasted 40 years. I mean, it should have. There's been a lot of people in, you know, who, especially in the early days, people like Jude Arnaru, who, you know, who really put a lot into it, got the thing set up and running, and then there's been a lot of other people who've come along and kept it running over the years. But, you know, it's a fun place to be, and people are here because they want to be here, and it's always struggling with different pressures of trying to make money and trying to present a program that is professional without being commercial, and you know that can be tricky at times, and I know that we certainly struggled with it back in the day. It seems to know where it is because it hasn't really changed much in the last, you know, at least 20 years that I can recall. It hasn't really changed. There's always been this, you know, there's certain things that you love and hate about it, and that's the thing that makes it different to other radio stations, is that other radio stations are kind of, it's like they're on Prozac. They're kind of good in a solid line, but BFM has highs and lows. It has manic highs when it's fantastic, and it has appalling drivel and shocking, you know, moments where you yell at the radio and you have to turn it off. But it excites passion in you, and that's what I think I love most about it. You know, and there's moments of pure magic. Radio magic that you don't really find anywhere else, you know, apart from, I think, you find some of the ex-BFMers who are doing shows on other stations, you know, people like Marcus and Graham Hill. You know, there are moments when you tune into those guys that you go, that is brilliant. There are fantastic highs and there are fantastic lows, and I love the fact that it makes me happy and it makes me just cringe with embarrassment and hatred. But I think it's a mistake to think that all other radio stations are shit, because that's not completely true, and I think that you know, there is good stuff out there, but this is like a bunch of friends with a jukebox, really, and it's, as long as it maintains that, I, you know, that's kind of what it's about. And you get rid of what's his name, Hockard, and what's that guy's name out there, Troy, and who else can you get rid of? Get rid of Mikey, get a Dubhead, and Stinky Jim's got to go. And do you want a list? I've got a full list here somewhere.
Paul, I want to thank you for coming in and talking to us tonight.
Cheers. It's been awesome. A pleasure.
And I'll just get you to introduce your last song.
I was saying before that how Huskadoo was one of those exciting tracks of the era. And recently when I came back to do shows in 2003 or 4, I came across this track that I was given by Anika Mauer and Madeline Sami that they'd recorded under the name of Titfuck. And it's just one of those tracks that I've just always loved. It's just a hilarious, stupid song, and BFM's the only place you're going to hear it.
Oh, yeah, me and my baby, we're searching for a heart of gold, but maybe I can't even trace that back to the time when I was young, yo. Dum diddy dum, yeah, check this flow out. Free, y'all. Me and my baby searching for a heart of gold. Yeah, I seen the needle and the damage done down Queen Street. Me and my posse to and fro in mid-40s. See the new buildings, they toppled them down, but do you see me frown? I've been to Hollywood, I've been to Red Bull. Me and my baby searching for a heart of gold. Dream up, let me fill your cup from the bottom to the top. Will my searching ever stop? to me is so much more than just a warm pop. Let's play roleplay, baby. I'll be the nurse, you be the cop. It's criminally ill, the lyrics I spill disseminate you. Make you scream, make you scream.
Let's go, let's do it. Let's roll, let's spice it. Oh, come on. Like a glove, I just wanna put you on. I wanna sing this song all night long. You know my move is smooth. I wanna have you in my groove, yeah. Come on, come on over here, oh yeah. I said, come on over here, oh yeah. I said, right over here. I wanna have you in my groove, yeah.
Happy.
Nothing matters anymore since I'm at my fucking pool.
Happy, happy.
Don't even try and say that to me. I'm gonna fucking kill all of us three. I got a bomb in my bag and I'm gonna set it off. Yeah, what are you doing? You're uncomfortable, it makes you cough. Whatever, you should give up smoking. Don't you know you're a statistic? Yeah, Maori woman smoking, toking up with your dope. I fucking think that you should wash yourself with soap on a rope. Come on now, shit, cow, butch, hoe, fucking mother hoe, yeah, come on. Butch, 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 fucking mother hoe, butch, 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 fucking mother hoe, butch, 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 fucking mother hoe, butch, 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 butch.
Fucking work it up, bitches. Fuck, what are you doing? I'm just over here with my boys and we're chilling. Yo, you bitches are making me fucking angry. Yo, I'm just trying to play the pokies and watch the league on the TV. Bitches, sort it out, sort your mess out. Go home, go to bed, have a sleep and fucking put your fucking minds at ease. Yo, just fucking go to back to school, you fucking need to, bitches.
Please, don't even come over and talk to me like that. You're crap, I've seen you playing pokies, you ain't win shit. Come on, let's take it on, till the break of dawn. I can fucking take you and your man and anyone that you want me to scorn. Come on, I can scorn you all night long. Come on, let's take it on, till the break of dawn. I can fucking take you and your man and anyone that you want me to scorn.
Oh, come on, oh, come on.
Happy.
Nothing matters anymore since I'm at my fucking pool.